Miranda Chung has a master's degree in public health concentrated on international health. She's a doctoral candidate at New York Medical College in health policy and management. She is also mentored and supervised by Dr. Deborah Viola, PhD, associate professor and director of the doctoral program. Her research interests include health services research, health policy, health disparities, the impaired population, the aging older adults population, maternal and child health, international health, mental health, and cancer research. We welcome Miranda.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Miranda Chung, and I will be presenting on the evaluation of the National Prevention Strategy and Healthy People 2020 goals with targeted improvements for the disabled, enhanced by the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. I have no relationships to disclose. I have to put that up. Why is this research necessary? Before I start with my background, I would like to express why this research is so important. It is to show how the importance of National Prevention Strategy, Healthy People 2020 goals, and the Patient Protection Affordable Care Act is, and how wonderful this triad will improve the quality of life for all. The Patient Protection Affordable Care Act recognizes that focusing on wellness and protection is the key to improving the health of all Americans, especially people with disabilities. This research will display evidence that policies, programs, and information can have a tremendous impact on individuals and their social determinants of health. In turn, the quality of life for all Americans will be improved through prevention, and wellness plans and strategies and initiatives. In the next few slides, I will be providing some background information on PPACA, the National Prevention Strategy, and Healthy People 2020 goals. The PPACA was signed by President Obama in 2010, expands access to quality and affordable care, healthcare. It is important to note that the ACA is more important than just insurance coverage. It is a unique opportunity to bring prevention to the forefront of our efforts to improve the health of Americans. The PPACA aims to reduce the number of uninsured by 32 million persons in 2019 with a net cost of $938 billion over 10 years. The National Prevention Strategy, the framework itself, released in 2011, proposed a change in emphasis from sickness to wellness. Its overarching goal is to increase the number of Americans who are healthy at every stage of life. The framework focuses on healthy and safe community environments, clinical and community preventive services, empowered people, and the elimination of health disparities. The NPS is supportive of Healthy People 2020 vision and goals. The vision of a society in which all people live long, healthy lives. Goal 2 and Goal 3, to achieve health equity, eliminate disparities, and improve the health of all groups. To create social and physical environments that promote good health for all. These goals are cornerstones towards achieving health equity and eliminating disparities for a more equitable society. At the heart of this diagram, Healthy People 2020 emphasizes the importance of individuals, their lives, and their futures. Ultimately, policies, programs, and informative information cultivate individuals and their social determinants of health, which is at the root of Healthy People 2020. The purpose of our study is to evaluate and reconcile the National Prevention Strategy and Healthy People 2020 goals to reduce disparities for adults with disabilities. We assess whether specific provisions of the PPACA have the potential to support initiatives outlined in the National Prevention Strategy and the Healthy People 2020 target of 10% improvement in prevention and reduction of chronic diseases for adults with disabilities. We mapped out a crosswalk of the National Prevention Strategy and Healthy People 2020 goals against PPACA provisions, supported by an extensive literature review that provided quality and qualitative and quantitative secondary data. After completing a mapping of targets and goals against ACA provisions, we conclude that high-risk pools for pre-existing conditions and insurance recession bans should reduce disparities among adults with disabilities. Patient-centered care, medical homes, and reallocation of resources of home and community-based services should improve the level of and coordination of services. Specific provisions intended for other vulnerable groups such as women, minorities, and older Americans should also improve the health and health care as well as outcomes for adults with disabilities. However, the implementation of state-level exchanges and budgetary decisions may have unintended consequences for lower-income groups. Medicaid and Medicare is vital to all that it's covered, but its benefits are particularly clear to people with conditions like cancer, heart disease, diabetes, and chronic lung disease, including older Americans and people with disabilities who need ongoing medical care. Unfortunately, because of current limits in Medicaid eligibility, tens of thousands of low-income people with serious health care needs remain uninsured. The Affordable Care Act will expand Medicaid eligibility in 2014, and that will give many of these individuals an opportunity to get Medicaid coverage and to be able to afford the care that they need. Overall, the PPACA supports the National Prevention Strategy, the Healthy People 2020 goals, with increased attention on prevention and access to care for adults with disabilities. Continued implementation of National Prevention Strategy with a focus on the strategic directions and priorities of the National Prevention Strategy, which align with the goals of Healthy People 2020 as well. The National Prevention Council will continue to engage both public and private partners, include state, tribal, local, and territorial governments, business, industry, and other private sector partners, healthcare systems, insurers, and clinicians, early learning centers, schools, colleges, and universities, as well as community, nonprofit, and faith-based organizations. Together, we as public health professionals can work to improve the health and quality of life for individuals, their families, and communities. This moves the nation from a focus on sickness to wellness. From priority areas of the National Prevention Strategy and Healthy People 2020 goals, major healthcare quality improvement initiatives were developed, such as the Partnership for Patients, the Million Hearts Campaign, the Multi-Payer Advanced Primary Care Practice Demonstration, We hope our research affects you all and therefore inspires you to do research on your own or to help others with disabilities, whether it is to help them with their application or in any way possible, to just lend a helping hand. And we as a team can help each other out. We hope to inspire you all to do that. These are my references. If I know you can't really see them, but if you need references from me, you can always definitely come and engage me, and I will be more than able to help you guys all. I'd like to thank my mentors and advisors, just to name a few. Dr. Viola and Dr. Murthy at New York Medical College, Dr. O'Hara at Westchester Institute of Human Development, and Dr. Schwartz, Dr. Mizra, Dr. Chesley, as well as Dr. Ezedigan at the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality. I would like to thank my colleagues at New York Medical College, APHA, and your attendance here today. Thank you very much.
The question was, when was the $2,000 asset limit set for Medicaid, and how much inflation has happened since then? I think, I mean, do you have, because I was going to say the answer is a long time ago, nobody's touched it.
And
it's never been increased. And if you think you could do it now, you can't get, although I hear Congress named a post office recently. They could vote on that. Okay, to summarize that was a thank you for mentioning the American Association on Health and Disability getting a grant from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, which I would say like 24 hours a day if I could, because I'm so excited they're finally funding disabilities again. And there will be a one-pager describing that that'll be available from, what was your name again?
Carl
Cooper in the back of the room, or Roberta Carlin later. So it'll be available during our meetings. Other questions? Yes. The question was, what are the 10 essential health benefits? And let me put that in context. The 10 essential health benefits, which were very much advocated by the disability community and everybody in this room, were a list of benefits, and I can read them to you. But I want to read them to you knowing that what ended up happening was we thought, wow, this is the panacea, it's going to be in everything. And then Secretary Sebelius announced that she was going to allow the states to decide how those 10 essential health benefits were going to be interpreted. Okay, so you had to like have them, but we weren't sure how. So right now, they're not the same in every state. So I'll read it, and then I'll tell you a little bit more about that. So it's ambulatory patient services, emergency service, hospitalization, maternity and newborn care, mental health and substance abuse, prescription drugs, rehabilitation and habilitation, which was very important to us with devices, a DME. Lab services, preventative and wellness services, and chronic disease management and pediatric services, including oral and vision. So the problem is, for example, states were allowed to pick they had to pick four plans, four benchmark plans. So let's say you get a plan. It says it has to cover prescription drugs. Let's say you have arthritis and you're on one particular biologic, but this only has to cover one drug in each category. So it may not cover your biologic. It may not cover your anti-seizure medication. So while it started out sounding really good, when it got operationalized, we're not really sure what's happening, and there's 50 different versions of it. Would you say that?
Absolutely.
All right. So,
in addition to 50 different versions, there's an essential health benefits for the marketplace and a different essential health benefits for Medicaid.
Where does that fall into? Which of those does that fall into? Is that
Well, epilepsy is a neurological impairment, so that's kind of where it fits, and the treatment depends on what you're covered. You know, I mean, there are so many different drugs, and some people respond to some and not others, and you may have a problem under the Affordable Care Act because your particular drug that works for you may not be on the formulary. It may not be covered by that particular plan.
We asked specifically, do you have that money in a bank account? We didn't look at special arrangements like that.
Yeah. The question was whether, in looking at assets, if they considered special needs trusts. As long as I have a microphone, I have a question for my colleague, too. when you were looking at, you said that younger people made more money, and I'm curious if you looked at what they were doing, what kind of work they did, because I'm thinking that maybe younger people are doing like computer stuff or something and making more.
Yeah,
or they
nationally they do.
Oh,
mathematical.
All right. Well, why did you consider income and what they were doing as a reason for why they had more assets?
The mathematical policy research has done the national evaluation of the Medicaid buy-in programs, and they are the ones that found that younger people typically have higher incomes, and they may have something about that in their reports, but I doubt it because they don't have a lot of personal level data. In our state, the predominant kinds of jobs that people have are service jobs. We have some professionals, but I can't say that they're disproportionately represented among younger people. I think maybe it's just the number of hours that people work.
Okay, the question was, do any of these plans cover dental care and the fact that teeth are essential to people's health? And the answer is only in children. And the reason for children is because Diamante Driver died because he had a dental problem and his mom couldn't find anybody to treat him. By the time she brought him to the emergency room, he had a brain abscess and he died. And he became the poster child for the CHIP program. And I can't tell you how many senators put that poster up of Diamante Driver and said, we need to cover dental. And that's how it got covered. But not for adults.
The question is on medical frailty, are there any estimates of how many people might qualify? I don't think there are. I did take a look at one point of how many people might get coverage through the Affordable Care Act, either through the marketplaces or the expansion, people with disabilities using the American Community Survey, and it was about 2 million people, and a good percentage of them were below, lower-income people. So I think it's going to be quite a high percentage that will qualify. The question was, how can people with disabilities find out information about the Affordable Care Act that they can understand? I can tell you that I did a webinar that's archived on United Spinal and American Association on Health and Disabilities websites. So that there are a couple of them, and they do a good overview of things. But when I did them, things may have changed a little bit the next day. But for the most part, it gives a good overview. As far as your stuff, was very novel to me and very interesting. Things are changing so quickly. I'm not aware of any that summarize it.
But AAHD is going to do that, right?
Well, AAHD, the webinars that I did, it's co-sponsored by AHD. AHD is going to be doing the Navigator. They're going to be teaching the Navigator. So there's going to be information coming out of AHD going forward. that's going to give people more information, but through the navigators, and maybe possibly handouts as well, I don't know, but there's going to be more stuff coming out. I could speak to that from experience because I have children with disabilities who I went through the PSIP, the pre-existing condition fund. She had to be uninsured. After she got off our insurance, she had to be uninsured for 6 months to get the PSIP. That's not going to happen going forward. So when your parents' insurance ends, you can go right into the exchange. And theoretically, there shouldn't be a gap. And I say that because it's very difficult to sign up. My daughter's looking at it now. There's 22 programs on the New York Exchange that she has to go through to see which meds, when you have multiple chronic conditions, which meds are covered, what, you know, which doctors are covered, what can I do going forward, where, you know. So it's complicated, but you can do it in advance. So in theory, it should be seamless eventually.
Yeah, I think the important question there is some people may in the transition go the disability determination route, you know, may go to this SSI, and they may not be aware that they can go to the marketplace also. So I think there's going to be that knowledge of, okay, I want to go to SSI and get cash assistance, but don't stop there, go to the marketplace too and enroll for coverage there as well. Well, the marketplace really should be quite seamless in that they're taking initial upfront information to either do the Medicaid determination as well or transfer the information to the Medicaid agency. So in theory, if that all works, it should be seamless and you should be able to do both at the same time. Sort of one caveat with the choices that I was talking about, people sort of have a choice up until the point that they have an SSA criteria determination. But once you have the SSA criteria determination, then you're precluded from all the new ACA stuff.
And yeah, I just want to, theoretically, there's supposed to be interoperability in the IT system so that whatever you sign up for, it looks at everything you might be eligible for. And I say in theory because, I mean, we're seeing websites not functioning, but on state levels, things are different. The question was, can you, if you choose a plan that doesn't have your meds, can you switch? And the answer is there's an annual open enrollment period like Medicare.
But does somebody have to change their formulary every year, or do they change it whenever they want?
If they
change it in July, you can't switch
to January. This is one of the things that we don't know yet, because we know, like, Medicare Advantage plans can switch whenever they want to.
Right.
Traditional Medicare can't.
And I think the Medicaid, the marketplace plans will have that open enrollment concept, but I think within the Medicaid expansion, I think that's a monthly determination. So if someone suddenly had a special medical need, I think they'd have the ability to switch that month.
A mapping needs to be done with all the measures in relation to the National Prevention Strategy, Healthy Goals, and the evaluation that I did for the ACA, and I will have to definitely put that together and then let you know.
Next year.
Yeah.
Next year's study. Unfortunately, no. However, there are provisions for case management, which, you know, those I haven't seen those regs yet. If anybody's seen them, let me know. There are also provisions for the ACOs, what are these? Accountable care organizations, where you can go to. It's unclear exactly how those are going to come out, but it's like groups that get together and say we're going to treat certain groups of people and we have all these services available. So that might also be of assistance to find an accountable care organization that's working with people with disabilities.
And what's the timeline for accountable care organizations?
They've started already.
Okay.
And they get like discounts and stuff or bonuses if, you know, so they're incentivized.
And is there an online directory that
That's a very interesting question. I would start by Googling accountable care organizations.
Yeah.
I think that's safer than expecting a directory from anywhere else at this point in time. Yeah, I'm not aware of specific education of the don't get scared with the work part, but I can tell you that AHD's grant is going to be educating people about how they can get health care and how the navigators can help them go through the process. I can also tell you that AHD and United Spinal have these webinars that we've done to educate people about what the healthcare reform means to them, but we haven't really put together the healthcare and the work, the employment piece. I know there's a researcher at Cornell who just did a presentation, Arun, I'm not sure of his last name, I can't think of it, Arun Karper, I think, just did a presentation at a NIDER conference on employment and ACA and what it means, or employment and healthcare issues in general. Absolutely. When we wrote that section of the Affordable Care Act, the idea was to sneak in stuff that nobody would realize was going to help the disability community tremendously. So when we saw that racial and ethnic groups were having data collection, we snuck in disability. And what's come out of that is consistency in using the 6 questions from the American Community Survey in everything. So anytime data is collected from now on, I mean, we had listening sessions we were invited to. We went to all kinds of things with CDC and with bigger HHS and all the agencies. Everybody's now going forward using the 6 American Community Survey questions. And the only reason I didn't have them in my presentation is because I didn't have time. But if you Google American Community Survey, you'll find the 6 questions. Some people don't like them because they think that it leaves out people with intellectual disabilities or it leaves out people with sensory impairments. But Steve Kay here? He did some crunching. He's probably at a meeting somewhere. And looked at, and it really does pick up everybody with those 6 questions. And we tried to get those 6 questions on the application because they had the one, and it was, we don't have room. So the disability community and the research community has been pretty consistent in advocacy at this point that those are the 6 questions that we're sticking with.
There's 6 questions on every federal survey.
Right. Yeah, those 6 questions are in every federal survey, or if they aren't, they're going to be.
Okay.
whether it's employment, you know, anytime you're identifying disability, those are the six questions. And so, there, you know, the research possibilities are going to be a lot clearer. Are there still other definitions? Well, yeah, unfortunately, Social Security has its own definition. And we still have, you know, there's still probably, you know, there used to be, I think, 52 different federal definitions of disability. And unfortunately, they're probably still there, but at least the data that's collected is going to be based on those six questions.
And what's the question on the application?
Oh, it's horrible.
It's really an ADL question. Do you have a single ADL or need living in an institution? The question is, what is the question on the application? And it's an ADL question, whether a person has an ADL or lives in an institution.
Do we have time for a few more questions? Anyone else? So I wonder if there's, I went to a different session because I wanted to hear if anybody talking more broadly about the ADA said this is really wrong and they didn't, or did they respond particularly well to the question I raised. And I think you're making it just wide and not deep, and the kind of reason that there are for people with disabilities in negotiating what looks like a promise but might not be real are substantial. I wonder if you talked at all about sort of moving alongside the question of the ADA if all the integrated rules and other capitated Medicaid and Medicare they're kind of parallel tracks. And in that context, it seems to me, are the great risks that long-term supports are going to be subjugated to health outcomes that are, you know, that they may be irrelevant to because independent living is the point. And the capitations are all getting cut at the top. So I don't know if you spoke to that, but I apologize. But I guess both relative to that and people with disabilities and ADA more broadly, I'm wondering what the strategies are about monitoring, you know, the lack of promise of rehabilitation services when you find out that you can actually have the weak or the tier or the substitution or whatever.
Mm-hmm. The question was, this is a tough one. How are we dealing with things like capitation and promises that were made about habilitation that may not really be happening? And is that like the gist? I mean, I understand what you're saying. I just don't remember. Yeah, we may not be as well served in the developments as we thought. I'm just going to make one comment, and then I'm going to let my colleagues answer this. But there was a lawsuit, I believe it was over multiple sclerosis under Medicare, about habilitation. And it used to be that if you got therapy, for example, if you plateaued, if you were no longer making progress, then you no longer got services. And this MS lawsuit against CMS kind of started to change things a little bit. It was limited to MS, but I think that if there are other groups that sue, the potential is there to broaden the concept that if I get therapy, I'm not going to decline. If I decline, it costs you more money to take care of me as a government. So I just want to throw that in the mix, that there's something there. I think there were a lot of promises. We know in the health disparities, we were promised a report. We didn't get it. And I'm going to turn this over to you guys to talk about.
Jean, I talked about the different coverage options available to people with disabilities. It's sort of the different end of what you're referring to. And people with disabilities are going to have new coverage options, whether it's the Medicaid expansion with either state plan Medicaid or essential health benefit Medicaid or market-based plans. I think with the medically frail regulations, we've got an option to use claims to figure out if people are in the right coverage, where we never did before. People had to go through disability determinations, and because it's work-based, you could never really use data to find out are the right determinations being made. But with medical frailty, I think states can look at claims and see, based on claims, if someone has a severe mental illness or other conditions that can be identified with claims, are they in the most favorable coverage for that?
And the only thing that I would add is that I strongly suspect that most of the Medicaid expansion coverage will be managed care, capitated care like you're talking about, and claims will be one of the main ways that we can see if people are getting the services that they were getting through regular Medicaid before. So we can make those comparisons, but I don't think there's going to be any quick fixes. We just have to document what's happened.